It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferris. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, our guest says the investigation into the Lincoln Hills Youth Correctional Facility is a chance to reform the state's juvenile justice system.
First, Governor Walker signed multiple bills into law dealing with criminal justice yesterday. Several of the bills expanded protections for victims of sexual assault and domestic abuse.
Some of these protections include ensuring that a victim's mailing address is confidential, that they get notification when their offender's parole is revoked, and that victims have an advocate when they're navigating the medical and legal systems. Another bill would allow domestic abuse victims to get the rights to their phone number transferred from their abuser to themselves.
Joining us now to tell us more about the new moves expanding protections for victims of sexual assault, domestic abuse, and stalking is Jason Stein. He covers the state capitol for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Jason, welcome back.
Thank you, Veronica. Good to be here.
Well, Jason, what would you say the overreaching goal was with the suite of bills that were just passed?
I mean, obviously, there's an attempt to fill in gaps in the law where crime victims may still not be getting the services they need, or where abusers may still be able to exploit loopholes to gain leverage on victims.
And before we get into the content of the bills themselves, what kind of support do these bills have?
You know, by and large, these were bipartisan bills. Many of them are modest in terms of the changes, but, you know, together they may change the playing field or level it a little bit more for people that have been victimized by serious crime.
All right, let's get into what was signed into law. One bill gives the right to have an advocate present. Tell us more about that.
Right. So up until now, this right to have a victim advocate present during parts of the case was available to victims of spousal abuse and certain other crimes, and it'll now be available to victims of sexual assault, human trafficking, or child sexual abuse. And the advocates for this law say that the presence of an advocate helps improve outcomes for victims who aren't necessarily, you know, represented by prosecutors in every situation, and obviously aren't represented by defense attorneys.
Who typically plays that role of advocate?
Well, you know, typically, historically, in our justice system, I mean, you have this adversarial relationship between prosecutors and defense attorneys, and they're not necessarily, although the prosecutor is obviously looking out for the people as a whole, the public as a whole, you know, it can be helpful, supporters of this bill say, and even essential to have someone there who's, you know, only focus is the rights and well-being of the victim.
And who in particular, how do you see this playing out in the courts then?
Again, these are situations where a victim, you know, they may, he or she may need to go through, you know, medical examinations as part of the criminal justice process. You know, they may need to go through interviews. You know, there may be a trial. And again, obviously, these victims would be in many cases among the most vulnerable targets of crime. So again, whether it's a battered wife or just a child. And again, the advocate would be looking out in these various situations to ensure that the victim is treated properly. And also the victim advocate has certain legal rights in terms of representing their client that an ordinary person, such as a relative, wouldn't necessarily have.
And there were a couple of changes, it sounds like, to a victim's mailing address and also the porting of a phone number. Can you tell us about those and why they're seen by advocates as so important?
Right. So there's a couple of different bills, both that aim to preserve the anonymity of victims who may be hiding from an abuser, as well as ensure that an abuser doesn't use you know, a tool of communication to get leverage over a victim. So the first bill creates a anonymous mailing system whereby a victim can go to the State Department of Justice, and, you know, when the program is up and running, the department will give the victim an address that the victim can give out and have, you know, mail forwarded confidentially to them so that they don't necessarily have to have their address, their actual address, put out in a way that it might, their victim, the victimizer might be able to find it. And in the other case, a victim or his or her minor child could also, you know, have the right to have a telephone number ported away from a victimizer, you know, in a case of, say, a restraining order that was issued by a court.
We're talking with Jason Stein right now, a reporter covering the state capitol for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, talking about some bills signed by Governor Walker yesterday that expand the protections for domestic and sexual abuse victims. And Jason, tell us about what we haven't covered yet.
Sure. So then there are another number of other bills that passed. One of them increases the funeral and burial allowance to relatives of homicide victims, also increases the compensation available to the parents of a child who's been victimized. Other bills streamline and improve the process for having sheriffs notify people that are targeted by a restraining order, and extending notification rights for crime victims in cases where a criminal has had their parole or extended supervision revoked. So all in all, the bills touch on a very wide range of aspects within the criminal justice system.
And looking at that that notification extension, what happened previously to the these changes as of Monday?
Sure. Previously, a victim could be notified when an offender had a hearing for release to parole or extended supervision or some other changes such as conditional release. Under the legislation signed by Governor Walker yesterday, the victim can also choose to be notified. Again, the victim's got to choose to do it. They're not automatically bothered about this stuff if they don't want to be. But if they choose, they can be notified when an offender has been released on parole or extended supervision and then had that revoked for violating one of the conditions of his or her release.
And Jason, what have we heard from advocates and groups who are in support of these bills about how significant they could be?
Sure. You know, I think there was a widespread praise for the bills. They had bipartisan backing. The governor signed them at locations such as domestic such as DAIS in Madison, which is Domestic Abuse Intervention Services. And, you know, I think this is kind of an ongoing process in many cases, like technology, cell phones, and the like. The practices in society and the things used by criminals are always changing, and so you see the legislature trying to adapt as time goes on to those changing conditions out in the state.
And Jason, as we wrap up, what about victims themselves? Have we heard from anyone coming forward who might have testified about these bills?
You know, again, there's a number of different bills, so I don't want to focus on what might have happened for any single one of them. But they did have broad backing from, you know, groups representing vulnerable victims around the state, and they did as well have, you know, the backing of, you know, very conservative and very liberal lawmakers within the legislature.
Jason, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you, Veronica.
That was Jason Stein, state capitol reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He joined us there to talk about some bills that Governor Walker signed yesterday, expanding protections for domestic and sexual abuse victims.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, we'll find out why our guest calls the new working class in America a sleeping giant.
First, as the investigation into the Lincoln Hills Youth Correctional Facility continues, some are looking at the situation as an opportunity for change.
The investigation into the northern Wisconsin facility went public in December of last year and has uncovered complaints of abuse, neglect, and sexual assault by staff.
State officials, including judges, legislators, and the governor, are still looking for ways to improve the situation at that youth prison. In a recent piece in the Capital Times, our next guest says this extra attention is an opportunity to reform the state's juvenile justice system as a whole. Jim Moser joins us now. He's worked in juvenile justice for more than 40 years. He's currently deputy director of the Wisconsin Council on Children and Families. Jim, thanks for joining us today.
Well, thanks for inviting me.
Well, you wrote that facilities like Lincoln Hills are the, quote, dinosaurs of the juvenile justice world. What did you mean by that?
Well, they are fading from the landscape all around the country. Some of it's the result of just the decreasing numbers of youth being confined around the country, the tremendous declines in juvenile arrests, and so there are facilities closing. And some of it is a result of states reconfiguring the resources that they have and downsizing, or what we might call right-sizing, downsizing institutions to be more effective at a more regional, local level than sort of these larger state institutions. So I think around the country there's dozens of smaller institutions that have closed and many, many sort of large institutions.
Right. This seems like a major question that Lincoln Hills raises, apart from the issues of abuse and neglect that we mentioned, the core concept of locking up young offenders in a facility far away from home, as opposed to something that keeps them closer to the community and maybe something more geared toward rehabilitation. Is that a thing where our school of thought is changing in recent years?
I'm not sure it's changing as much as, people realizing that, and maybe change is the right word, realizing that that the sort of large correctional institution model that has been more traditional in the adult world just isn't the right model for youthful offenders, and frankly isn't the right model for young adults as well. Putting large groups of offenders of any age in an institution, there are institutional challenges that come out of that make it difficult to really meet their needs and do the kind of work that should be done to get them back on track. And because youth are particularly susceptible to both influence negatively but also positively, if we can do the right thing, we have a great opportunity to get them back on the right track and get them on to becoming contributing members of the community.
Now, as you see it, what went so particularly wrong at Lincoln Hills?
Well, I think we have a lot to learn about sort of what went wrong. They've been in the middle of some transitions in terms of sort of changing practice and the kind of disruption that has occurred sometimes when programs have done that. They have tried to move towards more what people are calling trauma-informed care and reducing the use of isolation and some other more punishment-oriented strategies. That takes a lot of work, a lot of staff, a lot of training. I think we're finding, and I think we'll wait to find out, sort of what went wrong in terms of where that fell off the track. But the kind of difficult transition that occurs when you try to sort of unlearn what you have been doing to transition to a new model is very disruptive. Can be very disruptive for staff and for kids. And so I think they're a kind of a combination of staff challenges and kids who contributed to the challenges and we're making that transition very difficult.
Well, it would be a big transition to move away from a center like Lincoln Hills, again, a large institution, versus a more local community or county-based care. But what kind of things are you thinking we should be looking more at? What should be included in our vision of juvenile corrections?
Well, I think we should go top to bottom. There's certainly a lot of work that needs to be done on the prevention end. We are seeing counties increasingly developing and this has been occurring over the last decade or so, counties developing more community-based programs that provide good supervision for kids that are more targeted, that we're assessing kids better and targeting the resources in a better way and being more cost-effective in how we do it. A variety of both supervision, monitoring, but also treatment services that help kids and families work together to get the youth back on track. So that's been happening and needs to continue to happen, and we need to look at the juvenile justice system and the funding that goes into those aspects of the system. And then as we move into the deeper end, are there alternatives to these large institutions for that small number of youth who are going to need some kind of confinement and some period of confinement? And, that may mean some smaller regional facilities that are closer to southeast Wisconsin and maybe central Wisconsin and maybe western Wisconsin, but how can we there will be some need for some confinement. How can we do that in a way and take the resources we have and align them to be more effective in the long run, kind of from top to bottom, bottom to top, however you want to look at it.
Talking to Jim Moser, he's with the Wisconsin Council on Children and Families. He says Wisconsin should look at rethinking, changing the way juvenile justice works. He says this is a good moment to be thinking of it, given the ongoing investigation at the Lincoln Hills Youth Correctional Facility. Jim, as you described the changes at Lincoln Hills, you said it sounds like there were some well-intended, well-meaning changes, ending more punitive practices like solitary confinement, but the upfront work wasn't done enough in terms of training, maybe funding. So if we try to go toward a more local community model where there's confinement, it's in smaller, more local institutions,
sure.
There are more programs out in the community, how do we make sure that we don't have underfunded, undertrained systems that don't make that change work?
Well, I think you've hit on a really important point, and that is that I think one of the concerns I've had in following the Lincoln Hills effort is, you know, I think the staffing has to make the kind of changes that we're talking about or want to do to really be to provide better quality service and better outcomes takes more staff and takes more investment than we've been able to do. So we have to decide, you know, just downsizing and sort of in and of itself isn't necessarily a solution, and that's kind of what you're pointing out, is we want to make sure we invest in what we know works. We want to make sure the staffing levels are the right levels to do the kind of practice and supervision that we know is effective. We need to be able to really provide the kind of training, and it's a very, especially in a large institution like Lincoln Hills, a very long and arduous process to make the kind of transition that people were working on, and this has happened in other places around the country as well. And it's, you know, it can be a 5 to 7 to 8 year process of really making that change. So I, you know, I'm suggesting we look at sort of what's all going into the system, what are the resources going in. I think by and large I would argue that the likelihood is that upfront the cost is higher, but the outcomes are much, much better on the back end. So the investment pays off in the long run, although we need to really sit down and say, to make this work, what are the resources we need?
Right. There's been a lot of conversation about incarceration in the United States, a lot of a growing amount of bipartisan agreement that too many people are imprisoned. But part of the reason for that is, hey, it's costing us too much. So do you worry that if we go in with that mindset, we're reforming criminal justice, in this case juvenile corrections, with an eye to saving money, that means we're going to underfund these alternatives right from the start?
Well, I would hope not, but that's something I think that has to be continued. Those, you know, like myself, who are advocating for changes like this need to be there advocating that if you're going to do it, you got to do it well, you got to do it right. To get the outcomes you want, you have to make the investment. And so I think, and especially I think for youthful offenders, the community and the public is open to the notion that they're at an age where they can be get back on track, and that if we make the investment now in the right way, we can be successful. So I'd be confident that if we can explain it well and organize it well, the public would be supportive. But that it's not an easy thing to do, but it's I think in the long run a smart thing to do. And I think you see a lot of that in sort of the Smart on Crime initiative versus necessarily Tough on Crime.
Is there a place, maybe a county in Wisconsin or a state in the union that is doing it right, that you think is a good model that we should be looking at?
Well, a lot of people have talked about Missouri, which many years ago downsized their larger institutions and developed regional programs and had tremendously improved outcomes on the back end. New York has been going through this process with bringing kids closer to home. Texas has been doing this as well. Again, some of it's just downsizing by keeping kids in local programs, some of it's downsizing institutions. Some of the results of those programs are still to be seen, and that they're newer changes. So, I think the proof will be a sort of along the way, but we know the research about what works with youthful offenders can be much easier met at a local or regional level.
How much better is the outcome in general for a young offender who goes through a community-based system, less punitive, less corrections-oriented, versus confinement in a facility?
Well, you see reductions in recidivism. So, for example, kids who go to institutions, especially large institutions, maybe are struggling, you could have reoffending rates as high as 50-60%. You can cut that down to about 20-25%, cut it in half significantly or even more. I think Missouri reported about 8%. And, you know, significant reductions in reoffending behavior that have tremendous cost benefits in the long run. So it's pretty significant changes when you think about, you know, every offense is also a victim or two or three. And so if we could reduce even in the sort of grand scheme of things, the National Council on Crime and Delinquency estimates that if we could reduce reoffending in general by just 1%, it saves about $10 million a year.
You mentioned earlier that this, in many ways, comes down to public support.
Sure.
What's the benefit for the public of making this switch from larger-scale incarceration to more rehabilitation community-based programs?
You know, it really is that knowing that we're investing in something that's going to have better outcomes for the community, reducing reoffending, and getting youth who are at that point where they can be changed and can become productive into a path that gets them to be taxpayers, not ending up costing us more money down the road. So it can be a significant difference in having a kid go down a track of crime or a track of employment and education. Significant difference per kid that has a tremendous impact on our economy.
We'll leave it there for now. Jim, thanks a lot for joining us.
Sure. Sounds good. Thank you much.
That's Jim Moser. He's Deputy Director of the Wisconsin Council for Children and Families. He joins us to talk about how the investigation into the Lincoln Hills Youth Facility could be an opportunity to reform the state's juvenile justice system.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we talk about a new effort to preserve the Midwest's musical past by preserving folk music from Wisconsin indigenous and immigrant groups.
First, movements out to raise the minimum wage and address income inequality are signs that a new working class America is becoming a more powerful player on the national stage, according to our next guest.
She says the new working class looks different than yesterday's workers in manufacturing. It's a new group with far more women and racially diverse people than before working often in the service industry. And our guest says they have the power to transform the social and economic structures in the whole country.
Tamar Drought is with us now. She's the vice president of the national think tank Demos and the author of the new book called Sleeping Giant, How the New Working Class Will Transform America. Tamar, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, you've said that the changes to life for the working class are part of what drove you to write this book. Can you tell us a little more about your family's history?
Sure. So I grew up in a household where neither of my parents went to college. My dad worked at the local steel factory in Middletown, Ohio for 29 years, and my mom was ultimately became the office manager at a local orthodontist office. And, you know, despite not having college degrees, we were able to really achieve a middle-class lifestyle. And by that, I mean a level of economic security from decent wages to health care benefits. We always had enough food in the house. We even took yearly vacations down to Myrtle Beach. And most importantly, they were able to pay full freight for me to go to Ohio University, which is a state university. And I left in 4 years without any debt. And I really contrast that with today's working class, which, you know, as you said in the setup, the service sector class, working class, is much more female and much more people of color. And as we shifted from a working class that made stuff to one that serves people and one that is much more female and much more racially diverse, we've had a working class that has been really marginalized and devalued and shut out of our public debate.
Well, as you say that working class of decades ago that made stuff, that working class was a powerful force to be reckoned with politically. That cloud has waned over the years. And in your book, you say that now there is more working class solidarity in the United States than at any time since the 1970s. But as we look at divisions of race, of ideology, alongside the decline of unions in many places, including Wisconsin, how can you make that case?
Yeah, so, you know, I spend a whole chapter looking at the new organizing of and by and for the working class across the country, from Austin, Texas, to Seattle, Washington, to Kansas City, Missouri, and also at the national movements that are much more familiar to all of us, Black Lives Matter, the Dreamers, you know, which are the undocumented immigrants who have been pushing for better immigration policy as well as in-state tuition. And then, of course, Fight for 15. And I think these are enormous movements that have, at their best, really brought new cross-class, cross-race alliances in a way that we haven't seen since the heyday of the labor movement. And even then, you know, the labor movement at its best was really a cross-racial alliance in the effort for economic and racial justice. At its worst, it wasn't. But these new movements, I think, are showing that it's tough work, but that solidarity can be built to achieve real economic and racial justice, and that those two issues are deeply, deeply intertwined.
Well, talking about the definition of this new working class, we've mentioned women, people of color. Who else is in this new working class?
So there's certainly still plenty of white people in the working class. I define working class in the book as people who are in the labor market without four-year college degrees. And I chose that cutoff for a couple reasons. But the most important is that if you look at the quality of life in terms of job quality, the amount you earn, whether you have retirement savings, whether you can afford to send your kids to college, the reality is that over the last three decades, there has been a sharp divergence in those being able to attain those, you know, middle class factors of life between people who have college degrees and people who don't. It is becoming a much sharper dividing line in our society. So that's why I define working class that way.
We're talking with Tamara Drought right now, vice president of the national think tank Demos and the author of the new book, Sleeping Giant, How the New Working Class Will Transform America. And you've said that in a lot of cases, the working class in general is more progressive than its college-educated counterparts. Where do you see that most clearly?
You see the progressiveness of the working class really on economic policy issues, particularly on questions about whether everybody should be able to go to college, a public college, and leave without any debt, on whether the minimum wage should be high enough so that full-time workers don't live in poverty, on questions of how to raise revenue in this country to pay for things that would benefit all of us. You see much more support for raising taxes among the richest among us. So it's really on economic policy issues that you have a working class that is much more hungry, much more supportive for a more active role for government in ensuring that we have decent living standards in this country.
So economics is one point of agreement. Where does it break down a little bit and start to diverge?
Yeah, so this is where it really diverges, especially among the white working class, and that is on issues of race and on issues of immigration policy. And I think, you know, if we look at the ascendancy of Donald Trump's campaign, it really is based on, you know, decades of polling about the white working class. He's blending an economic populism with a very strong anti-immigrant, xenophobic, racist appeal. And that comes straight out of the polling data that we see with the white working class.
And so how does that play out? If you're talking about a new working class that you see poised to exert a lot of power on policy and politics, they have to work together, don't they? So which wins out when different systems and viewpoints come into play?
Well, I think, you know, it's not to say that there are not white working class people who are deeply progressive and tend to vote Democratic. That has always been the case, and it's still the case. My argument is that this new working class is more racially diverse than the old working class. And I think with that development, we do have a working class as a whole that is more progressive than previous working class voters.
And yet this working class isn't yet wielding the kind of influence you're talking about. So what is standing in its way?
Yeah, I think there's some really important challenges, and they're big challenges. I think building a larger movement means tackling the legacy of racism in this country, because I think that the working class has really been marginalized because so much of the work being done today is being done by people of color, particularly immigrants. I think it also a huge challenge is what I talk about in the book is social distance. Today, you know, if you look at the composition of the top staffers in Congress or our journalists, they are by and large now coming from pretty well-heeled, privileged households. And the reality is our sort of cultural news and policymakers, you know, often their only interaction with the working class is in commercial transactions. So those are two really big challenges. And I think it is possible that these movements will figure out ways to navigate those and turn those challenges into opportunities, but they're significant. But I think as we see, this week on April 14th is going to be another huge day of action by the Fight for 15. In just 3 years, they have elevated the issue of inequality and poor job quality among fast food and retail and adjunct faculty and home health workers. And, you know, already delivered millions of raises through minimum wage increases, most recently in California and New York. So I think momentum is building, and as, you know, success is contagious. As we see real success in getting policy changes and in changing the political debate, more and more people are going to join in this fight.
Do you see the things you're talking about coming into play with any of the presidential campaigns right now? Is anybody right now, does anybody have the ear of the working class and vice versa?
I think that absolutely. I think that you see trade, which is particularly important to working class voters, has been something that both the Democratic nominees and the Republican nominees have talked a lot about. And I don't think anybody headed into this election would have thought that trade was going to be one of the signature economic issues we're talking about. But it is, and I think it's great that it is. We see the minimum wage is also, at least on the Democratic side, a big part of the Democratic platform, and then the call for college affordability, which is very important to working class voters who, you know, get up and go to jobs and punch in so they can give their kids a better life. And that means really getting serious about making public college affordable again.
We're talking with Tamara Drought right now. Her new book is called Sleeping Giant, How the New Working Class Will Transform America.
And we want to hear from you. Do you think this new working class will ever have the political clout of the old working class in the heyday of unions, or is it too divided to be a unified force? What do you think is keeping some members of the working class from turning out at the polls? And do you work at one of these service jobs our guest is talking about? Do you feel motivated to participate in politics or left out, maybe by both parties? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. And we're talking about what might come next for the working class with Tamara Drought right now. Her new book is called Sleeping Giant, How the New Working Class Will Transform America.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you agree with our guest that working class America, while may not look like it has a lot of influence now, is a sleeping giant that will have influence in the near and mid-future? Are you working class? Do you consider yourself working class? How do you see politics? What issues are most important to you? Is there someone, a party, a politician who you think represents you? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we'll go to our callers now. We've got Lynn with us first in Eau Claire. Lynn, hi.
Hi, Veronica, and hello to your guest, Tamara. I am the great-granddaughter of a union martyr. And so it's in my blood. It's in my blood. And nothing was given to us by the corporations. Nothing was given. Lives were lost. I'm not suggesting we go back to that. I'm suggesting that we remember that and keep it in our hearts when we cast our votes, when we go shopping. It's really important that we do not lose the middle class dream.
Lynn, thank you so much for that call. And Lynn has a long history of unions. You can hear that. She's talking about remembering the strand of what unions stood for and what the middle class was in her family's heyday. But is that something that still resonates today, Tamara, the way that it used to, or could it still in the future?
Yeah, and I really appreciate those sentiments, because I think Lynn's exactly right. One of the things we have forgotten is how central unions were to the growth of the middle class in this country. And we take for granted that actual real blood was shed and lives were lost to fight for the right for workers to be able to organize their workplace. And, you know, as we've seen, and it's happening in Wisconsin, you know, this battle over the right to work laws. We've had such an erosion of labor law in this country where it is much more difficult to unionize your workplace today than back in the 50s. Corporations, arm themselves with high-priced consultants to try and beat back union efforts as soon as there's any whiff that employees are trying to win collective bargaining rights. So I really appreciate her bringing back the fight and appreciating that this was a huge fight that was fought, and we're losing it right now, and it's important that we don't let it go because economic democracy is a central piece of our overall democracy in this country.
But is the power of the union, is it ever going to be resurrected, or are you seeing that kind of sentiment that Lynn is expressing taking a different form going forward?
Well, I think what we're seeing is lots of innovation. I think if you look at the Fight for 15, which has been, you know, almost entirely funded by the SEIU, is a real acknowledgement by the union that it needs to do things differently. So far, that hasn't resulted in any new union members, but it has resulted in significant raises for millions of people in this country. So, that's the kind of social activism that unions have played throughout the history of this country. You know, they're the ones that got us Medicare and the weekend and minimum wage to begin with. So I think that it's vitally important that we both try and beat back what has become a viral strain of anti-unionism in this country, but that we also be at the same time innovating and finding ways to organize outside of the formal union structure.
We're talking with Tamara Drought right now, vice president of the national think tank Demos and author of the new book Sleeping Giant, How the New Working Class Will Transform America. And we'll go back to our calls now and take one next from Ken in Cambridge. Ken, hello.
Hi there. I'm kind of on the other side of the spectrum. You guys are forgetting about the small business owner. He can't afford $15 an hour. So these people in California are actually losing their jobs. They're either being cut, staff is being cut, going into automation. You know, and you try and sell a burger, how many more burgers you got to sell to make $15 an hour versus $8 an hour?
Ken, appreciate your call. And Ken's worried there about small businesses who would be maybe the least likely or least able to afford a $15 minimum wage in that. Does that factor into all of this?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. The argument about this will be too hard for small businesses is something that has been used time and time again as sort of a wedge to argue against paying employees actually what they should be paid for the work they do. So I think no studies have shown that there's been a decimation of small businesses because of minimum wage laws. Oftentimes it's small businesses that are leading the way in terms of paying their workers much better pay, providing better benefits than some of the big box retailers or fast food chains. So I think, you know, small business is not a monolith by any means, but this creates a level playing field. Everybody will be paying the same wages, and we can also rest assured that the cost of a hamburger is not going to triple in order to pay for this rate. It will go up a modest amount, but honestly, the purchasing power that people will have thanks to the $15 wage will more than offset any price increase in the cost of a hamburger.
And we're going to go next to Jill. Jill's joining us in Rhinelander. Jill, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just have two comments. I remember back in the day when Ronald Reagan was our president, he said he was going to change this to a service economy. And then he also purported the trickle-down theory. I guess I'll hang up and listen to your comments. Thank you.
Okay, Jill, thanks for that. And Tamara, what about the service economy? Does that matter when we're talking about the working class?
Well, I think it matters in that there's nothing inherent about the shift from making stuff to serving people that means that we had to completely degrade the living standards for the people that do those jobs. What happened was, at the time, three things happened. We saw the loss of union density as manufacturing jobs got shipped overseas. We have the backlash to the civil rights movement and the women's movement in terms of our political debate. So we now have levels of occupational segregation that have been left unchanged since 1980, where the lowest paid jobs are today still done primarily by people of color, and at the bottom is women of color. So I think there's nothing inherent about the service sector economy that these can't be good paying jobs, but as the other caller said, the demand has to be made. And I think that's what's so beautiful about what we're seeing right now. Demands are being made from the Dreamers, from Black Lives Matter, from Fight for 15, that are bringing together a new call for racial, social, and economic justice in this country. And it's been a long time coming. And so that's what's so powerful about what's happening today with the new working class. It is starting to stake a claim and make a demand.
Jill, thanks for the call. And Tamara, as we get ready to wrap up, one point we haven't touched on yet is when you say it's very important that what you heard when you spoke to people, one thing that they wanted to see in the working class was the restoration of dignity. Can you tell us more about what they meant and what they were looking for?
Yeah, this was one of the surprises in the interviews I did with people across the country in all kinds of different positions, is how much pride they really took in the work they did, whether they worked in the electronics department at Walmart or at Rally's, which is a burger chain, or as a home health aide. They took great satisfaction and pride in their work, and that simply was not reflected back to them in the workplace in terms of the arbitrary discipline and favoritism and unstable schedules to society in terms of their needs not being addressed in the public sphere. And so the return to dignity, I think, is a really important piece of the demands that are being made now. And wages are just one piece of restoring dignity to working class jobs.
Tamara, thank you so much for joining us today.
It was my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Tamara Drought is the vice president of the think tank Demos, and she joined us now to talk about her new book. It's called Sleeping Giant, How the New Working Class Will Transform America. And you can find an excerpt from her book and weigh in, tell us what you think, over on the Central Time Facebook page. It's Tornado and Severe Weather Awareness Week in Wisconsin, according to the State Emergency Management Department and the National Weather Service, and they're reminding people to have emergency plans in place for tornadoes and other natural disasters.
And the Weather Service just announced a change of style in the way it sends weather alerts. If you follow weather closely, being in Wisconsin, there's a good chance that you do, you've seen the Weather Service reports in all capital letters. It's kind of like they're yelling at us.
And now the service has announced that they're going to stop yelling. Starting on May 11th, they will use lower and uppercase letters like everybody else does.
This all came from old technology. The all caps format apparently came from old teletype machines that could only print in capital letters. Now we've got, you know, that internet and digital transmission of things, more common way to do this. And last I checked, the internet is capable of doing upper and lowercase letters.
I don't know. I'm kind of going to miss it. Maybe it's nostalgic, but you know, weather, when we read the updates from the National Weather Service, it is urgent and the caps get at that, right?
Yeah. And it was kind of weird to read it sometimes on the radio, which I think we've both had to do in the past. And you almost do want to kind of yell it because it's all caps. You know, it was hard to keep it at a good, mellow public radio read.
I think you were suggesting, Rob, maybe they could also include emojis.
Yeah.
The oh no face.
Yeah, the happy face. Hey, Sunny. Although, yeah, or like kind of a frightened face. Yeah, so let's do that. Next step, National Weather Service. Maybe in 50 years or so, they'll get on the emoji bandwagon.
You're listening to Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio.